Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I have found to be extraordinarily impressive and helpful is that of Anders Kaur. He is a principal these days at Kaur Analytics Incorporated out in the United Kingdom. He is also the publisher of the Journal of Political Risk and the author of Great Powers, Grand Strategies, The New Game in the South China Sea. Member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, as well. And always welcome guest here. Thank you so much for joining us again, Anders. Welcome back. So you circulated just this morning a very interesting and, I'm afraid, ominous piece that describes the agenda of the Chinese, I believe the BBC, was the outfit circulating the story, to use the COVID crisis, also known as the CCP virus, to justify the spread of a practice that they've begun using in China itself. Talk about it, both, you know, what it is and what it has meant for the people of China, this so-called social credit system and the health overlay on it.
Well, various countries have put forward the idea of having an app, health app, on everybody's phone, sometimes required in order to track COVID, because our smartphones are tracking where we are at all times. And so if two smartphones come into proximity with each other and, you know, one of those persons is known to have COVID, then those smartphones can be alerted and or tagged, and smartphones can have a red, green, or orange status. And if you have an orange or red status, then you might not be able to travel. You might not be able to board a plane. And Xi Jinping has just come out and basically said he wants to promote this globally. And there are Chinese apps that already do this. So he no doubt wants to promote the Chinese version of this as opposed to the South Korean version or some other version. And if he does that, of course, people will have all these Chinese apps on their phone, and they could be used for other purposes, whether it's intelligence gathering, snooping on people's private data. So I think it's a concern. It's certainly a privacy concern. And if we did have some sort of app like this, we certainly wouldn't want it to come from China. We'd want it to come from a trusted, you know, health authority like in the U.S. or some other, or England or Europe or something like that. So that's basically the situation. I think it's going to, the public is not going to like this idea very much. It's blowing up on the internet. The social media people don't like it.
One concern is, as you say, that the app may prove to be a Trojan horse on our phones. I guess what's of even greater concern to me, and perhaps a lot of other people who are responding badly to this idea, is that this really is, as I understand it, in China, an adjunct to a kind of political control system. Call it, I think, the social credit system. Talk a little bit about what that is, Anders, if you would, and how it operates to the detriment of rights and freedoms, or the aspirations even for freedoms of the people who are subjected to it.
Well, the social credit score is already happening in China, and everyone has a social credit score. It is a bit of a patchwork at this time, but it's slowly coming together into more of a unified system. For everyone who has a social credit score, it's kind of like a financial score in the U.S. Your credit score goes up and down, but for political purposes in addition to financial purposes. So if you say the wrong thing on the internet, or if your boss doesn't like you and wants to put a bad mark on your record, all of that data is aggregated and it gives you a social credit score. Now, if your social credit score is low, you can't fly in an airplane. You have to take a train. If it's really low, You have to take a slow train, not a high-speed train. And I'm sure it gets worse than that. As you go down the list, you could be invited for tea, as they say.
It goes, that's invited to tea by the authorities, which is not a positive thing, needless to say. But as I understand it, all manner of things can be withheld. It's not just your ability to travel. It can be, you know, having an apartment. It can be getting a job. It can be getting your kids in schools. It can be perhaps even affecting your access to food. These are measures that can be quite punitive. And the thing that's so concerning is if this is now available for export, as I understand is the case, especially if it's under the guise of just this seemingly innocuous, perhaps even desirable health monitoring application, it really could become a vehicle for much more comprehensive expansion of not just the Chinese influence, but sort of totalitarian controls worldwide, could it not?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And actually, this is not the only sort of globalization of China's authoritarianism. They've also recently started putting together a list of individuals of any nationality who have violated Hong Kong's national security law. So if you promote or support Taiwan independence or Hong Kong independence, China finds out about it, you'll be put on this list. And because the Hong Kong national security law has extraterritorial power, if you happen to fly through China, you know, and you're tagged on that list, they could presumably arrest you and throw you in jail.
The question is, could they even reach you in your native land? And I know that there are dissidents who have been affected in this way, including here in the United States. So it's not too far a stretch to anticipate that if the Chinese feel emboldened, and perhaps that's what's coming, if they sense that they will have an accommodating U.S. administration, should there be a Biden-Harris one, for example, that they may be able to apply this extraterritorial arrangement with impunity even in our own country. Let me ask you about one other question. There seems to be, given the influence of the Chinese with the World Health Organization, Anders Kaur, a likelihood that this arrangement, this social or health monitoring system, might well receive an endorsement from the WHO. Vice President Biden has indicated that he wants to get back in it immediately. Would you anticipate that this would be a mechanism for enforcing the application of these Chinese mechanisms worldwide?
I would expect that China would enforce it as a national country, and I would expect other countries. I mean, there are a lot of allies of China, you know, around the world, authoritarian allies of China. And if they adopt this app, you know, they would probably be enforcing it at a national level, I would expect. And any nation that adopts such an app would, you know, could impose a sort of draconian legal status onto its own citizens.
But I'm thinking of the WHO as yet another means of compelling nations, or at least strongly incentivizing them to follow this lead. We'll be following this story, as I know will you. Anders Kaur, thank you for your time today. Thank you for the work you do with us at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, among other things. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, we'll talk about foreign interference in our elections with Joseph Heumeier, about Venezuela's involvement and that of its friends and our other enemies, perhaps, as well. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say welcome to our next guest, Joseph Heumeier, as well. He is these days the executive director of the Center for a Secure Free Society. He is a Marine veteran who has served, among other places, in Latin America and has made that the focus of his efforts, I'm very pleased to say, including with his important book, Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. It's always a pleasure to catch up with him, and thank you, Joseph, for taking some time to do so today. Let me start with a question that is, I think, probably on lots of our minds that has to do with Latin America, but that is very much a problem here in the United States now as well. You have been tracking, I'm sure, the story of Smartmatic, company that was apparently founded by some of Hugo Chavez's cronies and has built cottage industry of voting, electronic voting machines and systems. What can you tell us about the provenance of this electoral hardware and software, and possibility that not only have malevolent forces in Venezuela, but perhaps Iran and who knows, Cuba, China, and others have now been given an opportunity to influence our elections as a result of our use of those machines?
Yes, Frank. So Smartmatic has a long and troubled history in Latin America and other parts of the world as well, but particularly in Latin America, particularly in Venezuela. It's a company that won a contract in Venezuela back in about 2004. And it was very unlikely to win the contract because it didn't have a history. It was a new company. It actually was the least competitive in a bid that was put out to be able to change the automated software that they were using in the electoral system in Venezuela. But the reason they won the contract was because they had close ties to the Hugo Chavez government. And so around the period of 2004 to 2005, the Venezuelan government completely changed their automated electoral system. They changed the machines, they changed the software, they changed pretty much top to bottom. They installed about 20,000 new machines throughout the country. And then since then, there was a lot of irregularities, but this really hit a boiling point in the 2013 election. And if you remember, Frank, that was the election where after Hugo Chavez had died and Nicolas Maduro came to power. That's the election that defined the Maduro regime. And so that was in April of 2013. And it was a snap election based on the fact that Hugo Chavez, who was the president, had passed away. And Maduro was running against a gentleman named Enrique Capriles. And the very similar thing that happened in the United States happened back then. The Capriles was trending to be winning the election up until about 6 p.m. when the polls were closing. And then they had a glitch in the internet. The internet went down. They extended the polling centers to about 8 p.m. And then when the internet came back on, the lead had switched, the flip. Maduro was ahead of him for about 200,000 votes, and then they called the election. And what investigators have found out after the fact, they found out that there was massive electoral fraud on three levels. One is on the ground, where they basically cloned polling centers. They took a polling center and they would clone it because it's connected to the internet. And then they would have teams available to do ballot dumping at the last minute. In cyberspace, where they actually had algorithms that were used to be able to play with the voter distribution. And I guess that was the key. Remember back then, they talked a lot about the voter distribution. They had to know where they were losing and where they had the registered votes to be able to make up the difference. And then lastly was in the legitimacy of the fraud. And that happened through the media and just basically, the claims that the international community did. And they got away with it. The Capriles actually initially told them that they cheated the election. The Venezuelan people knew that they cheated the election. But after a while, when Capriles basically conceded and he said, okay, fine, we lost, the thing got water under the bridge. But that was the inflection point that led Maduro become basically what he is today, which allowed him to never leave power since then. And so that was the history of Smartmatic. It did similar things in Bolivia, and it tried to do something. Well, it did was used in the 2019 election in Argentina, although there was no claim officially of fraud. There was some suspicion as well in that election. So it has a long and troubled history. But in the case in Venezuela, it was never officially proven, but a lot of experts and engineers did prove that they were involved in fraud in that election.
And you have studied closely, Joseph, over a period of time, the involvement of a variety of unsavory foreign governments in Venezuela, notably, of course, the Cubans, who have essentially propped up the Maduro regime throughout this period, but also Iran. Is there evidence of their involvement, and perhaps China and others, in some of these, shall we say, manipulable voting systems? And should that be of concern to voters in the United States as well?
Yeah, well, Smartmatic became an international company, so they actually had connections to other governments and other places. They were doing work in the Philippines. I think they were doing work in, I can't remember, another country in Africa. But nonetheless, they were operating more than just in Venezuela. Now, the typical nefarious actors that we talk about when we look at Venezuela, Russia, China, and Iran, one thing that we didn't know was that a lot of the parts that came into Venezuela to be able to set up these new voting machines came from China. They're all made in China. So they definitely had a connection on the hardware. Iran back then, they were obviously in Venezuela. I don't remember hearing anything about them being involved particularly, but Iran's very involved now. And actually, there's a lot of activity going on in the last few months, a lot of flights arriving into Venezuela. Obviously, the foreign minister came not too long ago. But one of the things that these my sources have been telling me is in these flights, they delivered all kinds of materials. And a lot of that material, it's registered on the manifest as electoral material. Now, we don't know what that means. Obviously, Venezuela has a sham parliamentary election in December. That's basically a fake election that they're trying to use to be able to take over the National Assembly. But it seems that Iran, whatever they're doing, they're sending, you know, quote unquote, electoral material to Venezuela. So it seems that they're definitely involved on levels probably we don't even see or even know about, because, you know, the way Iran operates is very covert.
I expect we're going to be hearing more about this. I've had tips that there is an Iranian connection, and we'll be back to you to discuss it when we learn more, Joseph Heumeier. In the meantime, one of the other things that I know you've been raising an alarm about is the prospect that some of the things that the Iranians are bringing in that may be even more troubling than electoral materials, whatever that is armaments of some kind. Talk about what they're up to there. You've written recently about this, and I'm anxious to hear your current reading concerning what you wrote about at the Gatestone Institute last month about Iran's next move, arms transfers to South America. What's the latest on that, Joseph?
I think Iran, what they're doing is they're hedging their bets that they're going to see a Biden presidency. And then in that, they're going to be able to lift sanctions and legitimize their arms industry. Obviously, after October 18th, according to Iran, they are no longer under an arms embargo because they believe that arms embargo was lifted. I don't think that's resolved yet in the UN Security Council. Nonetheless, the UN hasn't been very vocal about enforcing the snapback sanctions that are supposed to be reinstituted per the resolutions that they agreed upon. So Iran essentially is already moving ahead with that. I think they're starting to stand up. Basically an infrastructure that already existed on a covert level in Venezuela, now in Bolivia, and in other parts of South America, to be able in the future be able to help Latin American autocratic governments modernize their weapon systems. And this doesn't have to not just be Venezuela. This doesn't have to be Iran. Now, obviously, Iran itself is going to look to modernize its own weapon system, probably from Russian and Chinese armament. But so Russia and China don't have to run the risk of themselves getting sanctioned by moving and talking to someone like the Maduro regime on this. I think Iran's going to serve as a facilitator as well. So Iran's essentially setting up what I call a logistical air and sea bridge. So they found many ways to get to Venezuela to evade sanctions, and they use sanctioned entities, airlines, vessels, tankers. And so I believe that they basically are operationalizing a logistical network. And then if, you know, Biden gets confirmed as the presidency, I think they're going to start to move quickly to look to lift the sanctions, the U.S. sanctions, that is, and then start sending arms to these rogue regimes in Latin America.
This is alarming in the extreme, needless to say. Joseph, you've alluded to problems with the Biden policy towards Iran, should there be a Biden-Harris administration. Tony Blinken is now being rumored as the choice for a President Biden as Secretary of State. You tweeted out last week a powerful column by Mary Anastasio Grady at the Wall Street Journal about be afraid of Biden's Latin America policy. What would you anticipate will it look like in the hemisphere as well as in problematic places like Iran?
Well, you know, ordinarily, I think, a Biden-Harris administration, Biden-Harris policy on Latin America wouldn't be as radical in the sense that there's going to be firewalls, obviously. I think the Congress is going to be a firewall on things like Cuba, even on things like Iran and Venezuela. I do think it's going to be obviously differences in terms of how they approach something like the Venezuela problem set, where they're going to look at going more to multilateral institutions. They may look to eventually easing things and things like that. And I think, you know, here in Washington, you have a lot of discussions about that, and there's no sign that it's going to be a radical shift. That said, the real question to me is how much is Biden in control of his own policy? Now, the people that he has that would do Latin America, a lot of the same people that were in the Obama administration, for some of the people that he could put in the State Department, National Security Council. But my big question is, how long does a Biden coalition last? Especially with an election that was the way it was, because even if he takes the oath of office in January, it'll be in a very contested fashion. You know, the margin is very close. And what is the more extreme part of his party, of the Democrat Party? How are they going to accede to things? And the way things have been devolving, this isn't the same as when President Obama won in 2008 or when he won in re-election in 2012. The conditions in the world are much more severe, and I feel that our enemies are much more aggressive. And so my big question is, will a President Biden be able to stand up to these threats that are much more aggressive than they were before. Before, when we were facing the same threats at a smaller degree, it seemed to me like the Obama administration folded. They essentially went to the negotiation table and pretty much handed the house over to some of our enemies, including most notably Cuba and Iran. This question is, would that happen again? Would they get basically fold under the pressure? Because I guarantee, especially Iran, once Biden comes into the presidency, they're going to test him right at the front. And the question is, does he have a coalition strong enough to be able to stand up to that pressure? And that's my concern. And part of that pressure will come from Latin America. It will come from Venezuela and Cuba.
Joseph Humeyer, we'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. We look forward to having you back often in the new year. In the meantime, I hope you have a very blessed holiday this week and that you stay well and keep on the case of Latin America as it is one of our most important battlefronts in this war for the free world, whether we recognize it or not. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk with you again shortly. Next up, we will speak with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the elections and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs during the George W. Bush administration. He has been, in previous lives, a naval intelligence officer, a White House official during the Reagan and Bush administrations, and not least the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens. You can follow Robert Charles' very impressive and comprehensive contributions to public policy debate in various outlets, but most especially the Association of Mature American Citizens, or AMAC's outlet. It's available at amac.us. It's a terrific outfit, and he is its spokesman. Robert Charles, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You've written at amac.us a piece that I want to pick up on, especially with the information that Joseph Humeyer just shared with us about a company called Smartmatic and what it has been doing with Dominion and other providers of electronic voting services in a lot of states in this country that suggests, as some in connection with the Trump effort to establish the ground truth about this presidential election, including notably Sidney Powell, have been warning is evidence of fraud. And you've written, quote, "The Trump suits are real. Promoting ignorance is dangerous," at AMAC. Bobby, from your perspective as a former senior official in the United States government, as a man who has spent time with law enforcement, give us your sense of the ground truth here about whether we are looking at serious indications of not just fraud, but material fraud that may even have influenced the outcome of this presidential race.
So I think, Frank, you've asked really solid questions there. And obviously, one of the frustrations that all Americans, particularly the 73 million that voted for Donald Trump, have at this moment is that our legal system and the resolution of bona fides claims of mismal or nonfeasance, including fraud, take time to resolve. And in my past lives, I was a litigator in New York and Washington, and also a law clerk on the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. And one of the things that's frustrating is that cases would get to us a year or two after their initial disposition. We don't have that kind of time here. And so when meritorious cases are brought, very often, and you'll see in a sequence, I've got another piece coming up this week, in a sequence of these suits, and I won't name states, but state by state, what's often happened at the lower court level, which is a lower, like county circuit court level, or a state court level, is the judges have told the plaintiffs, which are both the Trump campaign and a group of citizen organizations around the country, one of which is represented, as you said, by Sidney Powell, that they've been told to voluntarily withdraw, or they've been dismissed without prejudice, to add evidence of mismal or nonfeasance to the suits. Eventually, these suits get appealed, and we've got a limited time frame, and of course, the courts know that. I'd like to think that one of them or two of them will show up in the not-too-distant future, as in days, before the Supreme Court. But the bottom and the court, I think now with a 5-4 majority of strict constructionists, may look at this freshly and give us a new understanding of what really amounts to fraud. The bottom line is there's two different real possibilities. One is voter fraud and one is electoral fraud. Electoral fraud can be manual. It can be the way that someone's cheating in the way that they deliver ballots or count them, and it can be machines. In this case, one of the allegations, and you can note how they've been divided here, the Trump campaign is bringing a number of cases that relate not to the Dominion machines, not to issues tied to machine-related incontinuities. But it looks like the group that is represented by Sidney Powell is focusing on those. And so I think that the thing I take away as a former law clerk and litigator is these suits are not being dismissed with prejudice as a result of a failure to state a claim. And affidavits, by the way, I keep hearing the press say affidavits are not proof. Actually, affidavits are proof. Affidavits are evidence that are submitted. Their credibility has to be evaluated, the materiality of what the witnesses say. And I have talked with affiants who were in Detroit and were in Philadelphia, and there's great realness to what they're saying. The question is, can you prove enough of a miscarriage here on the manual side, on the Trump campaign side, to bring it to the court so that the court comes to one of two conclusions, either a Bush-Gore kind of conclusion where it says that they are going to discount themselves a number of ballots and rethink the outcome by virtue of numbers that are based on fraud in some of these states potentially, or the other way around is to say that there are one, two, or three, or maybe four states that are in permanent dispute, that we can never know whether or not fraud at some high level occurred. And as a result, those states in dispute, their electoral votes remain in dispute. And then the requirement is under the 12th Amendment that, and it's not hypothetical and it's not conspiratorial and it's purely constitutional. At that moment, the case as to who won and how it should be decided goes to the House of Representatives with one vote per delegation. And at this point, the Republicans have a 22 delegation lead. And in fact, in the next Congress, starting in January, which is the one that would have to vote on this as a matter of law, very similar to 1886's election, which was actually decided early in 1887 by the House. The bottom line is that the Democrats actually lost two delegations. One was Iowa and one was Minnesota. And so as a result, it looks like the legal case could actually end up in the House. But the bottom line is this is not frivolous, absolutely not frivolous. It is. And I would, if I were Biden, I'd be saying, listen, this is going to hang over my entire administration if it turns out that I was right and they were wrong. Please dig as deep as you have to find the truth. That's not what we're hearing.
Yeah. And that's such an important point, Robert. I just can't overstate the significance of making sure that the tens, if not more, millions of Americans, and I say more because apparently, by one poll at least, 30% of Democratic voters think this election was stolen from Donald Trump. So it could be, you know, well more than the 70 or so million voters that Donald Trump secured support from. This is something that will be a blight on this presidency, and especially if some of the more, well, deeply problematic things that Biden and Harris seem to have in mind for us, in terms of the fundamental transformation of America, as Barack Obama famously called it, are actually what they intend to try to accomplish, they better actually have a mandate. They better not be legitimately accused of having stolen the election. So this brings us to the question I wanted also to ask you. I don't know if you've worked with Sidney Powell or not. She has struck me, and I know her reasonably well, as a highly conscientious and capable attorney. She's being vilified these days, as have a number of us over the years, as a conspiracy theorist, because she has zeroed in on what would be a very consequential line of attack on these elections, namely the mechanical kind, the electoral processes kind. And there's, it seems, considerable evidence of this. I've mentioned a film called Kill Chain in my commentary today. This is a riveting portrayal of deep and serious problems with the electoral systems, the hardware and the software on which most states in our union rely, Bobby. And interestingly enough, it was put together by people, I think, on the left, technical experts, but they seem to be more aligned with the left. I think it was initially scheduled for release sometime in September, out of a fear that Donald Trump would use these vulnerabilities to try to steal the election from Joe Biden. Well, it seems that wasn't the case, but it may have worked the other way around. I know you haven't seen this film, but I just wanted to really commend it to our audience because it seems to me to persuasively address this problem that our electoral systems themselves are at great risk. And Sidney Powell is quite right to want to get to the bottom of that. I don't know what your thoughts are. She's now being portrayed not only in this slanderous fashion, but she's being distanced from the Trump team itself, Trump lawyers specifically. Just quickly, your thoughts on all of that, Bobby?
Yeah, four quick thoughts. First, Sidney Powell is a distinguished attorney, and I think objectivity is my touchstone on everything that I can think of that I analyze. And number one, look at her record. She's an extraordinary attorney. She doesn't throw around false allegations. She wouldn't be as noted nationally if she did. I would suggest people think about what happened with the Flynn case and what she achieved by continuing to say there is a truth, there is a truth, there is a truth, and you need to find it. Point number two, our judicial system forces us, it's frustrating, but it forces us to wait. And I think that she's making claims relative to those machines, which again, if you go back and look at the public record about the companies involved, about the sequence, about the software, there is a very strong argument that that in fact she is right. Number three, that vulnerabilities are never discovered until they're discovered. And so we all think that, you know, we can never get a flat tire until there's a vulnerability in the tire and it goes flat. And all of a sudden we've got a recognition that there's an issue, that a vulnerability. Okay, now we learn that. Now we act against it. Same thing with voting machines. Last point, the separation of Sidney Powell's suits, which are in fact brought by a citizen organization, and the Trump campaigns is to me not particularly unnatural. They're keeping two separate rails here. One is a rail that's focused on machines. The other rail is focused on procedures that tie back to both voter fraud and electoral fraud that are non-machine. And to me, whatever the, you know, I've seen the exchange of press releases, I don't think anybody's particularly indignant about it. I think there's just a legal separation occurring here. People don't want the press or anyone else to blur the two. That's my view.
Got it. Bobby Charles, thank you very much for your time. As always, have a good Thanksgiving, my friend. Stay well and come back to us soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's, as always, a pleasure to say we are joined by the great Gordon Chang. He is one of our country's leading authorities on matters involving China and Asia more generally. You can find his work these days at, among other places, the Gatestone Institute. He is also a voluble contributor to various media outlets, including, I'm very pleased to say, ours, as well as the author of several very important books, including most recently, The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Gordon Chang, it's always good to have you with us and to once again encourage our audience to follow you at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Thank you for taking some time to join us. It's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much, the great Frank Gaffney. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let me ask you, Gordon, you had a piece that has just been published at Gatestone Institute, which is a terrific resource. I haven't had a chance to see it myself just yet, but I'm keen to hear what you had to say about one of my personal bêtes noires, namely Henry Kissinger. What is your latest take on him? What is his latest take on China, I guess, more to the point?
Henry Kissinger at the Bloomberg New Economy Forum on the 16th of this month gave an interview on China. And in a little over 14 minutes, he managed to totally misinterpret Chinese history. He supported Beijing's most important foreign policy goal, and he gave deeply misguided advice to Joe Biden. Really what he said was, if we don't cooperate with China, if we don't support the Communist Party, there will be war on the scale of World War I. And I believe that that is totally misguided, largely because between those two extremes that he posted about cooperation or war, there's also confrontation and deterrence. You know, Henry Kissinger is often held up as the master on the definition of deterrence. He was in the interview actually said that countries shouldn't get together to protect themselves against China. And that really is wrong in this point, because I think we can contain China. We'll have to be resolute. But nonetheless, you don't have to accept support of the Communist Party as a price of peace.
Well, let me just vent on my own personal peeve about Henry Kissinger. Far from being a master of deterrence, he has been a master of appeasement. His idea of how to deal with the Soviet threat was essentially to just try to cut the best deal we could. We were going to lose, and we needed to give them whatever technology, whatever money, whatever political legitimacy they demanded in order to have it come out less badly than it might otherwise. And similarly, he's been what I guess the Chinese would call a running dog of China since he participated in the opening of China with Richard Nixon decades ago. And so when we hear him say this sort of thing now, Gordon, it sounds like, defeatism once again. And the sort of advice that were it to be taken would, in fact, conduce to more bad behavior from China, not the deterrence of it, and possibly the very war that he's warning would come about if we stand up to them, especially with a reinvigorated alliance behind us.
You made many critical points there, Frank. One of them let me pick up, and that is Kissinger's defeatism. As you mentioned, in the early 1970s, he promoted détente because he believed that the Soviet Union was stronger than the United States. And he took the existence of the Soviet Union as a given. Fortunately, a guy named Ronald Reagan became president and said, no, we're going to win the Cold War. And that's exactly what happened.
And let me just say, if I can interrupt you for just one second, Ronald Reagan ran against Henry Kissinger in that election. It was against, of course, détente. It was against Jimmy Carter, most especially. But fundamentally, it was against the kind of defeatism and surrender that détente really represented. And thank God Ronald Reagan came along and spoke so powerfully about the need for a course correction and received the support of the American people in achieving it.
Yeah. In this Bloomberg interview, Kissinger was actually asked about the Congress of Vienna, because he wrote that masterful book, A World Restored, which dealt with Metternich, Castlereagh, and the Congress. And during that time, this holds lessons for us, because in Kissinger's book, he wrote that whenever peace, which was interpreted as the avoidance of war, whenever peace is the primary objective of the international system, well, then everybody is at the mercy of the most ruthless member of the world. And then he said, whenever countries and powers have acknowledged that certain principles could not be compromised even for the sake of peace, then stability was possible. And really what Kissinger's advice today about China, which is cooperate with the Chinese, what he's doing is he's suggesting the United States put itself at the mercy of the world's most ruthless regime, which is China. So, you know, Kissinger once was smart about these things, and he's completely forgotten about them. And he is putting the United States, and indeed the entire planet, at risk with deeply misguided advice.
Yeah. But advice, let's be clear, that would be very much consistent with and appreciated by the people for whom he has long worked, I would suggest, in Beijing. This brings me to how this sort of advice might be taken should Joe Biden become the next president of the United States. There are reports that Tony Blinken will be his Secretary of State. choice, and that Jake Sullivan, a longtime foreign policy hand, notably tied to Hillary Clinton as well as Joe Biden, might be his national security advisor. It's early days. We don't want to make predictions on the basis of past performance, as they say on the market. But Gordon, nonetheless, what might be the shape of a Biden policy towards China as executed by individuals with the track record of these two gentlemen?
Well, the Biden administration comes in with people with a very different view of China than the current team. And it's largely, I think, what we have seen from what people have written so far and what they have said, they believe that it is more important for the United States to strengthen itself rather than to impose costs on China. And they do believe, like Kissinger, that the United States should find areas of agreement. A number of people have made criticisms of their views. I think the one thing that we can say almost for sure is that every new team comes into the administration, and they try to develop cooperative relations with Beijing to sort of give them a grace period to see if the Chinese will respond. You know, even President Trump did this for about 14 months. But we're at a time where it's a very different China, and we don't have a moment to lose. So we can't afford a grace period. And therefore, we've got to be deeply concerned about what Sullivan and Blinken will do. You know, we have got to see. It's a very different China. And because of that, their responses might be closer to those of the Trump administration. But I believe that Trump came to his views not because he was, quote unquote, anti-China, but because China forced him into taking certain positions. And I think eventually China will force the Biden team to do the same.
I guess it's a question, as you say, Gordon, of how long it will take and how much we will see China able to capitalize on any delay or reversal or perceived reversion to a more benign view of China, or a China that is more benign, maybe is a better way to put it. And just very quickly, Gordon, in less than a minute, what would you say to try to persuade incoming senior officials, let's just say, about how different China is today than when they were in office the last time?
Well, China's attacks against the United States are even more malicious and more unrelenting. It's an existential challenge, and their number one priority is to defend the United States. And if they fail to do that, then history will hold them to account, and we will be in jeopardy even more so than we are now.
Yeah. This is, of course, the essence of what China has been about for decades, this unrestricted warfare against us. It's just that it's now unmistakable. And I think you don't have to be an expert on these matters as you are, though it helps. And your expertise and advice has been incalculably important, Gordon Chang. But even lay people can now see, I think, clear-eyed, the true malevolence of the Chinese Communist Party, and I hope will be represented in addressing it properly by whoever is the next commander-in-chief. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Gordon Chang, thanks for your time, and I hope you have a great Thanksgiving and that we will be able to talk with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.